The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Reading Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll be reading from the May 21st, 2018 edition of the New Yorker magazine. As usual, I'll begin today's broadcast with a short poem. This one by Cynthia Zarin, entitled Marina. The sky's gray mantle over me, sewn with lapis lazuli. The terrible sky where you walk in our city, not thinking of me. Your indifference bedecks me. The locomotive of my heart rattles past the crepe myrtle, the leaves startled, buds like jewels. The sun has no business in the sky, nor does the moon, nor the myrtle or its spattered blooms, not your gaze, now that you have turned from me. I am gauze, printed by twilight, barely a body. And next, from the Talk of the Town section, the Kids Today department, an essay entitled Darndest by Michael Schulman. A few years ago, Carol Burnett was doing a live Q&A in Texas, and a 9-year-old boy in the audience raised his hand. "You know who I am?" Burnett asked, incredulous. He answered, "Well, surprisingly, yes." And the audience went crazy. Burnett, who is 85, said the other day, "I wanted to take him on the road. He didn't censor himself." Now that the kid who grew up on The Carol Burnett Show are well into middle age, Burnett has been courting a new generation of fans. Her new Netflix series, A Little Help with Carol Burnett, convenes a panel of brutally honest children, ages 5 to 9, to solve grown-up dilemmas for celebrity guests. When Lisa Kudrow asks about double booking friends for lunch, one boy advises, "Don't have a friend." Along the way, the kids learn about rotary phones while Burnett picks up Instagram and some hip new slang. "I learned stay woke," she said. "I used it in front of the same kids a few weeks later, and they said it was passé." Burnett was sitting in the principal's office at PS 212 in Hell's Kitchen, waiting to meet a group of first graders. She wore a white blazer, dark slacks, and tinted glasses, and was accompanied by her longtime manager, Steve Sauer, who wore a suit and tie. "Evidently, I swore as a kid," she said. "I don't remember who I learned it from, but I could cuss." Her three daughters also used to say that the darndest things, she said, recalling a time when she had to chide her youngest, Aaron, for refusing to eat her dinner. Toward the end of the meal, she looked at her father and said, "I love you." And he said, "I love you too." And she said, "I also love your wife." And I laughed so hard I let her have dessert. Burnett now has two grandsons, with whom she texts. She pulled out a photograph of Dylan, 11, who had bleached hair and wore a Tupac Shakur t-shirt. "Last year he had his hair green," she said, giving the last word a comic warble. She was led down to the classroom past two kids who were building the Great Wall of China out of cardboard and sat in a director's chair. A teacher, Brian Andes, said that the children had prepared by watching clips from The Carol Burnett Show and Once Upon a Mattress, the 1959 musical that gave Burnett her breakout role. 55 first graders swarmed in and sang Hello Dolly, rewritten as Hello Carol. "We've been studying Jerry Herman," a blonde boy explained. Burnett read a storybook version of The Princess and the Pea and then submitted two questions. A girl with a blue bow in her hair asked, "How did you get your role in Once Upon a Mattress?" "Well, I was just starting out trying to be an actress in New York, and I got a phone call to come down to the Phoenix Theater, downtown on 12th Street," Burnett recalled. "I read the scene, and I was so excited because the director was a man named George Abbott." The kid seemed unfamiliar with George Abbott. I was in the show for a year and we did 8 shows a week. Well, but there were not even 8 days in a week, a boy said skeptically. You're right, Burnett said, and a girl with a ponytail asked, how did you learn to be so funny? Well, the first time I got a laugh, I was actually an old person. I was 18, Burnett said. I was a freshman in college, and I took an acting course. And she leaned in. Are you funny? Make a funny face. And the children obliged. A girl wearing a headband asked, how do you change your voice to be so many different characters? Burnett pondered. Do you know who Tarzan is? And they were familiar with Tarzan. Well, when I was a little girl, we'd go to the movies, and then we'd play act the movies that we liked. So when we saw Tarzan, I became Tarzan, and I taught myself to yell. You want to hear it? And she cleared her throat and bellowed to the screams of the laughter. I could do Charo, too. But they were unfamiliar with Charo. A girl in a Hello Kitty t-shirt asked, why do you tug your ear? I was raised by my grandmother, Burnett explained. When I got my first job on television, she said, well, you've got to say hello to me. And I said, gosh, Nanny, I don't think the television people are going to let me say hi to my nanny. So we picked the secret signal. I would pull my ear, and that was just for her. The earlobe is actually a little bit longer now. When time was up, the children sang the farewell song from the Carol Burnett Show. I'm so glad we had this time together. And they all tugged their ears goodbye. And now from the fiction section, a short story by John Lee Roux entitled The Long Black Line. Brothers. Finn said an awkward goodbye to his parents and watched them drive off in the new Buick they had bought in case he changed his mind. They were pleased, of course, at Finn's decision to study for the priesthood, but they were wary, too. It was 1954, and priests were still thought to be holy, and Finn knew that he wasn't holy, but during retreat in college, he had succumbed to a fit of piety, and dizzied by the idea of sacrifice, applied to join the Jesuits. They had put him through a series of interviews and let him know that he seemed altogether too caught up in the theater, but in the end they had accepted him. So now here he was, almost a Jesuit, and this annoying Brother Riley kept calling him Brother. Brother Riley had given him a short tour of the public areas, the chapel, the guest parlor, the dining hall, and then escorted him to the front veranda, where the other postulants had gathered to admire the grounds. A green lawn cascaded down the hill to a small wilderness of trees with a lake beyond. Everyone agreed that it was beautiful. They stood in little groups, sweating in their jackets and ties, while the novices, the real Jesuits, made awkward attempts at conversation. Finn introduced himself to the group, around Brother Riley, and after the expected handshaking, silence descended. Finn was not good with silence, so he cleared his throat and wondered aloud if they all felt as strange as he did in his jacket and tie. There was eager agreement and a little self-conscious laughter that encouraged him to wonder further when they would get to wear a cassock. If it's okay to ask, he said. A habit? Brother Finn, not a cassock, Brother Riley said quietly, a gentle rebuke. Sorry, a habit, Finn said. But when? In good time, Brother Finn. Finn realized that he should shut up, but he couldn't help himself and attempted friendliness. He said, just call me Finn. Brother Finn kind of creeps me out. Brother Riley, with a show of patience, explained that in the Jesuit order, all novices were called Brother. He pointed them out, Brother Quirk, Brother Matthews, Brother Lavelle, etc. And in lapsing from charity, he added, you are now my brother, Brother Finn, and I don't like it any more than you do. Nervous laughter, a fit of coughing from Brother Lavelle, and then silence. Finn blushed and muttered to himself, I've always depended on the kindness of strangers. I've always depended on the kindness of strangers. That night, Brother Riley made a note in his manuductor diary about Brother Finn's singularity. Jesuit speak for self-importance, and he added, I wonder how long Brother Finn will be among us. Then, during examination of conscience, Brother Riley went to confession and accused himself of disedifying conduct, sins against charity, and anger against one of his new brothers. Anger was a habitual failing, he admitted. He would try harder. Brother Riley had been appointed manuductor. Quote, he who leads by the hand, end quote. Because even now, as a second-year novice, he was brusque and withdrawn, inclined to hang back from group activities. He had served as a Marine in Korea, and he remained gaunt and hungry-looking, with an intensity that seemed to border on the dangerous. His superiors had judged that he was ill-suited to the role of manuductor, and that therefore it would be a useful trial for him, and an instructive one for the novices. Feelings, Father Superior explained, are always to be distrusted. Jesuits are men of the will. The good Jesuit may feel excited or depressed, but remember, he never shows it. He is never singular. He disappears into the long black line. This was a talk that Father enjoyed giving. It was essential that novices learn self-denial, and denial of feelings came first. Agere contra, to act against. Here is your safeguard against the dangers of feeling. If you feel sad, smile. If you feel elated, exercise self-restraint. If you dislike someone, pray for him. Take note of his virtues. Imagine that he has virtues, even if he has none. Agere contra, be a man of the will. Finn listened, eager and anxious, certain that they would never have let him in if they knew what a S-word he was. But maybe this was a feeling he should just ignore by an act of will. Brother Riley must be a holy man, Brother Quirk said to Finn. Well, what makes you think that? Well, they chose him as manuductor, and he never violates silence. Maybe he just has nothing to say, Finn thought for a moment and added, well, that was uncharitable of me. I'm sorry. Brother Lavelle cleared his throat and spat. Brother Quirk and Brother Lavelle and Finn had been assigned weeding duty during recreation, weeding the tomato patch, where there were, in fact, no weeds. And since they were outside the house, talking was allowed. Inside the house, talking was forbidden, except in emergencies. And then you had to speak in Latin. If your Latin wasn't good, you were expected to learn it or shut up. Well, also, he was in Korea, Brother Quirk said. God help the Koreans, Finn said. And then to change the subject, he added, these tomatoes are on their last legs. What do you think, Lavelle? Brother Lavelle never talked, but now he sat back on his heels and said slowly, deliberately, I think this whole effing thing is a mistake. And he stood up and looked around. Christ, he said, and without asking anyone's permission, he walked back to the house. Finn, for once, remained silent. But later he noticed that Brother Lavelle was absent from dinner and evening prayers. One down, Finn said as they left chapel that night. Brother Riley heard him and gave him a hard, knowing look. In conference, Father Superior explained the use of what were facetiously called scroop beads. A tiny string of beads attached to a safety pin and worn inside the habit allowed you unobtrusively to pull down a single bee each time you broke silence or sinned against charity or had an unkind thought. The beads kept you scrupulously aware, hence scroop, of your failings and came in handy at the twice daily examination of conscience. Wearing them was, of course, optional. Finn waited for Father Superior to say, just joking, But Father Superior was not given to jokes. The new men, still wearing jackets and ties, finally began their 8-day retreat. The silence was absolute, and time stretched out endlessly before them. Their world contracted to an intense focus on Father Superior's conferences, 3 a day, followed by an hour of private meditation as they tried to engage each of their 5 senses in the day's topic: sin, heaven and hell, the life and teachings of Christ, the gospel mysteries, the wonders of living the Christian life. Finn thought of Brother Lavelle. Maybe this was all an effing mistake. But as the 8 days passed, he found himself surrendering to the power of silence and meditation. Most nights, he lay awake while the others slept. On the last of the 8 nights, his mind wandered from Christ's resurrection and the empty tomb to the summer theater in Vermont. Jillian Cantrell had been his girlfriend that summer, a sophomore at Brown. She was a good actress, full of life and wit, and she was very sexy. Too sexy for him. Jillian. Sexy Jillian. He thought of his last night with her. He found that he was getting aroused and forced himself to think of Mary Magdalene and the empty tomb. The problem was that Finn had always wanted to be an actor. He had spent the summer after high school studying at the New Theater Academy in New York, and after his first year of college, he had acted in summer stock in Vermont. Acting was fun. Acting was thrilling. In his sophomore year, he'd acted in every play the drama department had put on. At the same time, he'd had this secret life in which he gave himself over to prayer. One night, on his way back from the library, he decided to make a quick stop at the college chapel. The place was dark, with only the red sanctuary light blinking next to the altar. It was sort of spooky, and Finn was glad that nobody could see him. He knelt in the back pew and closed his eyes. After a while, he felt foolish, as if he were faking some kind of piety, and he decided to leave. But when he opened his eyes, he was startled to see the flickering red altar light move toward him. He blinked, and it moved again. The dark and the single red light moving toward him in that dark, it had to be an optical illusion. But for a moment, his heart stumbled, and looking back, he knew that that was when he'd seen it clearly. Acting was not enough. The best thing he could do with his life was sacrifice it. And what better way to sacrifice it than as a Jesuit? Suddenly, from the bed nearest the door, there came a terrible shout. It was more than a shout. It was a wail of pure terror, and it seemed to go on and on before trailing away into silence. Someone turned on the light. Someone else said, "It's Brother Riley. It's the manuductor." Brother Riley, the manuductor, still fighting his way out of his dream, pulled himself together and said in a shaking voice, "Everything's fine. There's nothing the matter." And he turned off the light, saying, "Sleep, everybody." And he left the room. Incredibly, they all slept, even Finn. The next morning, their trial period behind them, the new novices were accepted into the common life of the Jesuit community. It was a free day, with a sung mass in the morning and a special feast in the evening, and benediction before bed. Finn was at last a member of the long black line. Once in a dark wood, Brother Riley had had a fit. The word went around during laborandum that afternoon work period. It happened once before, Brother Kirk said, when he was in his first year. "Oh, it was worse," Brother Matthew said. "He woke us all up howling. He dreams he's back in Korea." "Well, my brother was in Korea and my father was in the last war in Germany, but they never wake up howling." "Well, I wonder why he does it, why it happens, I mean." "It's a cross to bear," Brother Quirk paused, then added grimly. "The real cross is that he may have to postpone vowels for a year." "For howling?" "Oh, it's canon law. His mental state. His fits may be an impediment to ordination. like epilepsy or schizophrenia or even facial disfigurement. What? You mean if you're too ugly, you can't be ordained? Finn doubted this. That would mean a lot of priests got through by accident. Father Taylor, for instance. Well, or Father Hansen. You'll be a close call yourself, Quirk. A very funny, Brother Finn. We should pray for Brother Riley, and we shouldn't be talking about it anyway. It's not charitable. Brother Riley, meanwhile, was resting in the infirmary. It was called rest, but he knew that. In fact, he was under observation. Superiors wanted to know if his fits were incapacitating or if, as the neurologist had assured them, he was merely having flashbacks to the war. They should just wait and see, the doctor said. Brother Riley knew all about waiting. When he first applied to the Jesuits, he interviewed with a psychiatrist whose job it was to vet all incoming novices. And it emerged that as a Marine Lance Corporal in Korea, Riley had spent a good deal of his downtime with local prostitutes. The psychiatrist thought it would be wise for Riley to see if he could get by without sex for a year, and so he recommended postponing entrance. Riley endured his year of chastity and applied again. This time he was approved by the psychiatrist. He was a dutiful novice, if quiet and withdrawn, but then one night he woke up screaming. It was his first fit, which he passed off as a bad dream. But now it had happened again. Finn was tempted to make a smart-ass remark about Riley, but for once he held his tongue. He was briefly proud of himself, and then ashamed of his pride. Mentally, he put down a scroop bead. Brother Quirk was appointed manuductor. Suddenly, he was everywhere, making announcements, reminding his brothers about changes to the schedule, and posting a new demore notice. It was the same old schedule, but elaborately printed to resemble an illuminated manuscript and translated unnecessarily as regular order. Finn stood before the notice board during his rabbit imitation, doing his rabbit imitation. 5:30, rise. 6, visit chapel. 6:15 to 7, meditation. 7 to 7:45, mass. 7:45 to 8, breakfast. 8 to 8:30, free time. He drew a deep breath. The rest of the day was divided into blocks of time for conference, rosary, class, examination of conscience, lunch, 2 hours of assigned work, study, more meditation, dinner, chores, spiritual reading, a second examination of conscience, and finally at 9:30, following a last visit to chapel, bedtime. At least they give you time to hit the toilet, Finn said to anybody listening. And as God would have it, that happened to be Brother Riley, who looked at him as if he were an insect. Finn's rabbit imitation had come to him during a visit to chapel. He was wondering what made Brother Quirk so annoying, and with no shame at all, he stared at him. He looked like Bugs Bunny. His front teeth stuck out a little, and he had a nervous tic that sometimes made his lips twitch. Just like a rabbit's. A pious rabbit, that is, with a pronounced Dorchester accent. Finn pushed his upper lip forward and exposed his front teeth, and for an awful moment he became Brother Quirk. It was unkind. He wouldn't do it again. But later, alone in a toilet stall, he tried it one more time. Just for practice. Grace is God's free gift. We can't earn it. We can't deserve it. God gives it to whom he wills. Finn knew this well, and he found it depressing. We can open ourselves to grace by constant prayer, but we can't merit it. It's given gratuitously. Finn's mind watered. Was novitiate life making him infantile? Other men his age were fighting in Korea, and here he was on his knees, confessing to uncharitable thoughts. Whatever happened to making his life a sacrifice? Well, it was visiting day. On the great south lawn, guests gathered in groups, anxious to greet the new Jesuit in the family, with his new black habit and his new air of holiness. Finn's group included just his parents and himself. They had brought him presents, a black sweater, winter gloves, a huge box of chocolates. And Finn thanked them lavishly. But he was proud of his new poverty and couldn't resist telling them that gifts of any kind became common stock. "We don't own anything. Isn't that wonderful? If somebody needs a sweater, he just asks, and they'll give him this one." But we got it for you." "There isn't any me anymore, Mother. Not like that." Her eyes filled, and she said, "Don't."
"He's just being dramatic, Claire," his father said. "Let it go." Finn bristled at dramatic.
But he knew that his father was right and found himself blushing. "I love the sweater," he said. "Maybe they'll let me keep it."
"You don't want to ask for exceptions," his father said. "A rule is a rule." It was the old family dynamic. His mother hurt, and his father stepping in to lighten her disappointment and shift the blame to Finn. This was how it would go. She would be depressed tonight and need her tranquilizers, and his father would lie awake beside her, talking until she could finally get to sleep. And the unspoken blame would be laid on guess who. Finn leaned over, kissed her on the cheek. "My sweet old Mutty," he said. "She's the best." And she raised a hand to protect herself, but Finn was determined to salvage their day. "Come on, Mamu," he said, and pretending to twist her ears, he made motor sounds. "Start your engine. Come on. Lift off." Until she pushed him away, saying, "People will see." But she laughed, and his father laughed, and so the visit was saved. The afternoon was made easier by brief visits from the young priest, Father Lomax, who taught the novices Latin, and by Father Spaulding, the old priest who taught them Greek. They said hello, and welcome, and goodbye, smiling and nodding as they moved on to the next group.
"They're all so nice," Finn's mother said. "What about that young man, the one who showed us around last time? He was very nice."
"Brother Riley has fits."
"Oh, no."
Finn thought, "Here's a good story." But he knew it was a story that he had no right to tell.
"Oh, he has screaming fits in the night," she said. He said, "Well, that's awful. We had one a few weeks ago. He started screaming, and I mean major, full-on screaming. It was the middle of the night, and we all woke up, and we were terrified. You can imagine. Riley, of all people." Then he stopped, and everything went quiet, and he said, calm as could be, he said, "Everything's fine. There's nothing the matter. Just go back to sleep." And he left the dorm and went down to the infirmary, and he was there for days. It was incredible. Finn paused. This was all wrong, he added lamely. He had a fit.
"Poor man. Isn't there anything they can do for him?"
"It's shell shock or something." They were quiet for a while, thinking. And Finn broke the silence. "I probably shouldn't have told you that."
"Well, it's sad. It's a sad story. I shouldn't have told it," he said again.
Toward the end of the afternoon, when they all seemed talked out, his father said, and it was obvious that they had planned this, that if ever Finn wanted to leave, they would completely understand that what they cared about was his happiness, and that's all. They wanted him to be happy. And Finn assured them that he was happy. And then finally it was over. Visiting day had been a great success. Finn, however, felt sick. He had squandered what little progress he had made in the spiritual life. He had trivialized it. He had talked it away. Demore for months now. Mass and meditation, spiritual conference, and on, until litanies in chapel, and so to bed. And then Father Larson arrived. He appeared one day at noon, silent, forbidding, entering the refectory behind everyone else. He looked ancient. His back was crooked, and he walked slowly, bent over. His habit hung on him like a shroud.
But it was his face that was shocking. A thick scar ran from his left eyebrow down to his chin, pulling his mouth a little to the side, so that he appeared to be sneering. The novices, observing custody of the eyes, pretended not to see him. They stood for the prayers before meals, and when they sat down, Father Superior declared, Deo gratias, which meant that they were all free to talk. Finn, who was waiting on the faculty table, noted that although the priests spoke quietly among themselves, Father Larson hardly spoke at all. Later, as Brother Quirk gave out laborandum assignments, he explained that Father Larson was ill. He was completely off limits. No confessions and no spiritual advice. These were orders from Father Superior. Father Larson had been a prisoner on the Bataan Death March. He had survived torture and starvation, but he had never really recovered. So here he was to rest. Period. The novices had many questions about the death march and about the torture, what had happened to his face, but it was work time, and Brother Quirk sent them on their way. So Finn felt deeply betrayed the next day when, coming out of chapel, he saw Brother Riley leave the line of novices and join Father Larson, who was waiting for him on the veranda. They exchanged a few words and then, like old chums, took the path down to the lake. Finn went off to Laborandum to dig up more goddamn potatoes and wrestle with his jealousy of that effing Riley. Winter was long and cold, but at last the snow melted and Lent began, and Finn was a changed man. He no longer imitated Brother Quirk, or broke the rule of silence, or said witty things at the expense of his brothers. Moreover, he was content. He felt no need to perform. He listened while Brother Haberman told his stories about life in Dorchester, and he dutifully learned the names of Irish parishes in Southie. And when he and Brother Riley were assigned to the same work crew, Finn did his best to draw him out. They were planting those everlasting potatoes. The day was cool, but Finn felt uncomfortably hot, except for his hands, which were freezing. He was tempted to complain, but he concentrated on Brother Riley instead. Finn scooped out a hole and buried a chunk of potato, the eye facing up. I guess this isn't much like the Marines, he said. What is, as a matter of fact, mindless tasks and no women? Finn pondered this, shocked. How about that? I noticed you walk with Father Larson. What is that like? It was an order from Father Superior for my mental health. Oh, and then, what do you talk about? I mean, what does he talk about? Baseball, sports. Sports? But he must talk sometimes about, well, about being a prisoner. Brother Riley punched a hole in the dirt and said nothing. He was pale with anger. Or about the death march. Cut it out. Would you just cut it out? All of this S. Honest to God. Finn fell silent. And at the end of the laborandum, when Brother Riley said, I apologize, Brother Finn. Finn resisted the urge to tell him to shove it and merely said, I shouldn't have pried. My fault. Later that day, he learned that Brother Riley had been told he would have to wait another year before taking vows. Poor Brother Riley. Finn went to chapel to pray for him. He didn't feel well. He had a pain in his chest and his breathing was strained. He was coming down with a cold. Never mind. It was another thing he could offer up. Semper Fidelis. Brother Infirmarian was old, and he was tired. Over the years, he had given pills to countless novices who had dealt with doubts about their vocation by working themselves up into a fever. Finn's temperature was 101, nothing surprising. So Brother gave him the strongest cold pills he had, the yellow and black ones, and told him to take a lie down instead of laborandum for the next few days. A day passed, and then another. And though Finn took the yellow and black pills, he was racked by a constant cough and dizzy with fever. His coughing distracted everybody during meditation, so he was sent back to the infirmarium. His fever was now 103, and he was badly dehydrated. So Brother Infirmarian, against his instincts and principles, admitted him as a patient deserving of antibiotics and his devoted attention. Finn began to feel better at once, and after his second day, he hoped for visitors. Maybe someone interesting would get ill, Finn thought. Just slightly ill, and he'd have a roommate to talk with. He should have guessed it would be Brother Riley. Brother Riley had had another fit, even worse than the previous ones. He woke, raging in the night, loud and obscene, with a soaring fever and a compulsion to talk. He was brought straight to the infirmary. Far from being company for Finn, Brother Riley continued his fit, mumbling angrily about whores and gooks and dead Marines. This called for Seconal, Brother Infirmarian decided, along with his own private concoction of honey and water and a little whiskey, for the love of God. Brother Riley slept through the entire day and then through the night, muttering the whole time. By the following morning, he had quieted down and showed signs of returning to himself. Around noon, he growled something unpleasant to the infirmarian, and toward evening, with a grunt and a moan, he acknowledged the presence of Finn. At 10 o'clock, lights out for the great silence, Brother Riley had recovered sufficiently to attempt a chat. He was groggy, but plain-spoken. "I disliked you from the day you arrived," he said. "I know you did. I disliked you, too. But I prayed about it." "Did it work?" "Not really. I'm sorry about your vows." "F the vows." Well, this was too much for Finn. "We're not supposed to be talking during the great silence. I'm not going to talk." "F the great silence." Brother Riley fell asleep then, and when he woke in the middle of the night, he was shaking with fever and his teeth were chattering. He called out to Finn. "I'm sorry for what I said, Finn. Finn?" "Well, thank you for calling me Finn." "I'm having a fit. How are you?" "We're not supposed to talk during the great silence." We could say the rosary together." Finn got out of bed and padded, barefoot, across the dark room to kneel down beside Brother Riley's bed. They said the glorious mysteries, with Finn starting the prayers and Brother Riley responding. Finn was eager to finish and prayed fast. "Amen," Finn said. Finally, and Brother Riley said, "Amen." Finn knelt in silence, in the dark, unsure what to do now. Brother Riley made a choking sound, as if he were trying not to sob. "Are you all right?" Finn couldn't bear the silence. "I wanted to be a Jesuit, to make up for my life."
"To sacrifice it?"
"No, to make up for it. To atone for all I've done."
"Well, I wanted to make my life a sacrifice. Self-obliteration for God."
"You gotta be careful what you ask for. Sometimes you get it." Another long silence. "It's late," Finn said. "Do you want to get in bed with me?"
"Yes."
Finn astonished himself. Because that was indeed what he wanted.
"But I don't think it's a good idea."
"Well, it wouldn't be anything sexual. We'd just hold each other." Finn felt himself getting hard. "I just want to hold you," Brother Riley said.
"I don't think I can do it."
"The truth is," Brother Riley paused, his voice shaking. "The truth is, I need to be held. I need to be held." Finn thought about this and shook his head. I can't, he said, and then determined, "I won't." He went back to his bed and tried to sleep. He could hear Brother Riley moaning, perhaps crying. Finn blocked his ears and turned from side to side. Finally, he got up and took one of the two seconals from Brother Riley's nightstand, and in minutes, he fell soundly asleep. Finn woke the next morning groggy and numb, barely aware that something was happening around him. Brother Infirmarium and Father Superior were wheeling Brother Riley out to the corridor where an ambulance was waiting to take him to the hospital. Finn turned his face to the wall, guilty. What had he done? But he had no time to consider what he had done, or, more important, what he had not done, because Brother Infirmarian had decided that it was time for Finn to go. He wanted his infirmary back the way it should be, empty. In no time at all, Finn was standing at the Demore bulletin board, where a notice from Father Superior suggested that, to prepare for the priest of St. Ignatius, they should all meditate on the vows. Finn was distracted in his meditation by thoughts of Brother Riley. Do you want to get in bed with me? He had wanted to, and he had nearly done it. He felt his face burn. He would go to confession during this evening's examination of conscience. But when the time came, Finn couldn't bear to tell all of this to Father Superior. So he went to old Father Spaulding, the Greek teacher, who had taught at several different Jesuit colleges and had heard everything. Besides, he was a little deaf. Finn confessed that in the infirmary, one of his brother novices had asked him to get into bed with him. He just wanted to be held, but I knew it was clearly an occasion of sin, Finn said, and I knew it was my own fault. Father Spaulding belched softly. That's all, Father. Father Spaulding sighed and said, I know. And he gave Finn a long talk about loneliness and religious life, and the importance of chastity, and the danger of friendships that became emotional. He paused. And as if he were merely distracted, he said, religious life is not for everyone. But be of good cheer and pray for a peaceful heart. Vow day came and went while Brother Riley remained in the local hospital. After 2 weeks, he was transferred to Shrewsbury Mental and then was released to his family. On his first day at home, he shot and killed himself with his Marine service pistol, but not before writing a letter to Finn saying, My death happened years ago and has nothing to do with you. Have a happy, holy life. And it was signed, Love, Brother Riley. Father Superior opened the letter, as he opened all novice mail, and after he had considered the matter at prayer, he called in Brother Finn and told him of Brother Riley's death. Finn went white and slumped in the chair, but said nothing. He put the letter in his inside pocket next to his scroop beads and went downstairs to chapel. He sat in the back pew and tried to think, but he didn't know how to think anymore. And the old words kept circulating in his brains. Finally, it came to him that he was to blame for everything. Finn knocked at Father Larson's door and waited. He knocked again and heard a kind of grunt, and so he pushed the door open and entered. The room was thick with smoke and smelled of whiskey. Father Larson was at his desk. He looked annoyed, and he pushed his drink aside. I don't hear confessions.
I know, Father.
Or give spiritual advice. Or listen to novices' sob stories.
No.
Father Larson turned his scarred face toward Finn so that he seemed to be sneering. Well, what then? I'm not able to help you, whatever it is.
It's about Brother Riley.
Father Larson pushed aside the book he'd been reading, the New Testament in Latin and Greek. He lit a cigarette and told Finn to sit down. What's this about Riley?
What's about his death?
Who told you he's dead?
He wrote me a letter before he did it.
Riley was a good man. A good Marine. An awkward silence, and then Finn blurted out, It was all my fault. And he began to sob, softly at first and then louder. And he choked finally and blew his nose, and he said, I'm a mess. I'm so sorry. Father Larson pulled deeply on his cigarette and waited. Finn told him of their instant mutual dislike. Mostly my fault, Finn said. He searched for the least offensive words and told him about the encounter in the infirmary and his refusal to get into bed with Riley.
He wanted to be held, Finn said, and I refused.
And he looked at Father Larson and his scar and said, it's all my fault.
Is it?
Father Larson said. Or would that make you more important than you are? This caught Finn's attention. Father Larson tapped the ash from his cigarette and looked at him, as if that were an invitation to tell him everything. Finn began with wanting to be an actor, and exchanging that for scroop beads, and his struggle with the rules, and on and on and on, until he reached that desperate scene with Brother Riley.
He wanted to be held. What he said, he just needed to be held, and I refused.
Father Larson sat back in his chair. He said to Finn, would it have been so bad to get into bed with Riley? Would there have been terrible harm to anyone?
Do you mean I should have? Is that what you're saying?
Father Larson hesitated and then said, I would have. Poor S that I am. Sometimes we have to risk our soul to save somebody else.
But it would have been a mortal sin, Flynn blushed. Because I wanted it. He paused. I wanted to get in bed with him. I was aroused. I had an erection. So I walked away and left him there. He paused again. I stole one of his pills and went to bed. The next morning they took him to the hospital. I'm to blame. I blame myself.
A man kills himself. A sick man. And you, in a monstrous act of proprietary guilt, you blame yourself. Father Lawson lowered his voice to a whisper. You. It's all about you. I really think you should go. I think you should leave now before it's too late. Finn made a choking sound. Leave! Before you turn totally inward and rot.
Leave? Finn echoed.
Everything you've told me is about you. Your guilt, your blame, your pitiful erection.
But I was following the Jesuit rule, or trying to.
You've turned it inside out. You're supposed to be growing in Christ, and instead you've been growing in self-satisfaction. The clock ticked on Father Larson's desk, and from the chapel came the sound of the bell for litanies. Then there was silence in the room, and it was terrifying.
Is this because of Riley? Finn asked.
Riley has nothing to do with it. Father Larson made as if to wash his hands. You should go. You should leave the Jesuits. That's the only help I can offer. That's it. Finis. The end. He sat back again. He was done with Finn. He had said the painful, necessary thing, and now they both had to live with it. He lit another cigarette. He was exhausted. He said, this is why they don't want me dealing with novices. Finn thought, so this is despair. Reading his mind, Father Larson said in a hard voice, don't despair, kiddo. There are plenty of other ways to sacrifice your life. 2 days went by. Finn found that he could not pray. He went through the motions of meditation, mass, and thanksgiving, but he was not conscious of praying. He was merely existing, a testament to shame and disgrace. And then, on the third day, he woke at 5:30, de more, yawned, and before going back to sleep, at that precise moment and with a joyful heart, he decided to leave the Jesuits, admit his failure, and let sacrifice find him when he was ready for it. He slept until nearly 8 and got up just in time for breakfast. It was Friday, which meant pancakes, and he had 3 of them, with extra syrup. He looked frankly around the refectory at his brother Jesuits. He admired them this morning, men who had made a free choice and, at great cost, were trying to disappear into the long black line. Finn did not want to disappear. I'm free, he said aloud. The other novices continued eating. Everyone knew that Brother Finn was impossible. Finn left that afternoon. He had Father Superior's blessing, and he made a last visit to chapel with no sense of regret. He felt comfortable in his jacket and tie. And as he stood alone at the train, he was visited suddenly by feelings of remorse. He wouldn't have it. "I'm free," he said, loud again. "I'm free." Just to hear it, "I'm free." And then he shouted it, "I'm free." The platform was empty, and it felt right and true. But with a year's grace behind him, unearned, undeserved, he recognized that this freedom was only temporary, and that the words he shouted to the empty air would come in time back to him and back in a pale echo. Brother Riley, Father Larson. But for now, life was good, and Finn chose it. The train arrived, and Finn got on and left. Next, we'll turn to a summer preview of movies. The summer's visionary speculations run the gamut from the fanciful to the bleak. The science fiction romantic comedy, How to Talk to Girls at Parties, opening May 25th, about teenage boys who find themselves flirting with aliens, is based on a short story by Neil Gaiman. It stars Elle Fanning, Nicole Kidman, and Matt Lucas, and is directed by John Cameron Mitchell. Tessa Thompson and Lakeith Stanfield star in Sorry to Bother You, opening July 6th, a metaphysical comedy directed by Boots Riley about telemarketers endowed with supernatural powers. Armie Hammer, Terry Crews, and Danny Glover co-star. The director, Peyton Reed, whose comedic touch enlivened Ant-Man, returns with Ant-Man and the Wasp, opening July 6th, in which Scott Lang, played by Paul Rudd, and Hope Van Dyne, played by Evangeline Lilly, team up to ward off evil. Amanda Stenberg, The Hunger Games, and Harris Dickinson from Beach Rats star in The Darkest Minds, opening August 3rd, a dystopian fantasy about a society that imprisons everyone under the age of 18 and a group of incarcerated teenagers who rebel against it. Jennifer U. Nelson directed. The summertime blues come to the fore in a variety of teen-centered movies, including Leave No Trace, opening June 29th, the director Deborah Granick's drama about a teenage girl, played by Thomason McKenzie, and her father, played by Ben Foster, who clashed with the authorities while living off the grid in rural Oregon. The comedian Bo Burnham's first feature, Eighth Grade, opening July 13th, is a comedy about a 13-year-old girl named Kayla, played by Elsie Fisher, who's dealing with her impending transition to high school. The Miseducation of Cameron Post opens August 3rd and is directed by Desiree Akhavan and stars Chloe Grace Moretz as a high school student who is caught up by her parents in a relationship with another girl and sent to a conversion therapy camp. In Josephine Decker's drama, Madeline's Madeline, opening August 10th, Helena Howard delivers an inspired performance as a high school student struggling with mental illness who seeks a creative outlet by acting in a New York theater troupe. Miranda July co-stars as the girl's mother. Molly Parker plays the theater company's director. Political tales take many forms this season, as in the drama The Catcher Was a Spy, opening June 22nd, based on the true story of the Major League Baseball player Mo Berg, played by Paul Rudd, a graduate of Princeton and Columbia Law School, who was recruited by the U.S. Army to do espionage during the Second World War. Ben Lewin directed. Lauren Greenfield, who made the documentary The Queen of Versailles, returns to the subject of outrageous fortunes with Generation Wealth, opening July 20th, a historical essay film about the latter-day obsession with the ultra-rich. Spike Lee's new drama, Black KK Klansman, opens August 10th, based on a nonfiction book by Ron Stallworth. It tells the story of an African-American detective in Colorado who goes undercover as a member of a Ku Klux Klan chapter and is eventually elected as its leader. John David Washington stars as the detective, Adam Driver, Laura Harrier, Topher Grace, Paul Walter Hauser, and Harry Belafonte co-star. This preview was by Richard Brody. And now we have time for one or two cartoons. The first one, we see a bride and groom standing in front of a priest, and the priest is holding the Bible, and he is saying, "And do you both promise to believe you can be better than all the other married couples you've ever seen?" In the next cartoon, we see a young married couple walking out of a house, and the wife says to the husband, "When you enthusiastically declare Pam's layered jello salad is better than sex, I fear some may see it as a commentary on me and not the layered jello salad." And finally, we see two cavemen squatting down, one of them holding a rock. He's looking at the rock and he's saying, "You ever pick up a rock and then forget why?" Well, sounds like we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I have enjoyed reading it today. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.